Big Adventures with Brian Durker is brought to you by SWCA. Since our founding in Flagstaff in 1981, SWCA Environmental Consultants has helped public and private clients overcome environmental challenges and move their projects forward. As we celebrate our 40th year in business, our 100% employee-owned firm offers comprehensive environmental planning, regulatory compliance, and natural and cultural resources management services. We are the problem solvers, the scientists, the planners, the technical specialists, and the creative thinkers. Thank you, SWCA, for your support of Big Adventures. Now with the show.
This is Brian Durker, Big Adventures, and I'm sitting with none other than the Big Dan Hall.
Hello.
Hello, Dan. Hey, Dan Hall has an interesting story like you wouldn't believe. And Dan, I'm really appreciating you making it by here with your busy schedule.
Well, happy to be here. I had to schedule it for some time.
Months out. It's been months.
It has been.
For you guys listening, especially you past listeners, there's a lot of different people involved in this community, and Dan's been an integral member of this community in so many different ways, and we're going to find out all about that. But he's a scientist, he's helped the River Guides Association, the Whale Foundation, he's been super involved with this community, and I think a lot of people forget how much he contributes. And so, Dan, it's great to have you here. Though I want to start out, you know, kind of what is your early story? I start out this way with everybody.
Yeah.
You're from Madison?
Correct. Yeah, that's right.
Give us your babydom into high school.
Well,
and family stuff. You come from a big family.
Yeah, big Catholic family raised in a cult, we believe. And, we grew up in a neighborhood that was right on the outskirts of town. So we had kind of nature and fields and farms right outside our front door practically. So we got to explore a lot when we were kids. Plus, you know, I think I had the luxury of growing up in a really safe community. Parents watched out for all the kids. You know, we were outside all the time. And
That's a wonderful. A lot of people that I have sat with and talked to have kind of a similar connection to nature from their childhood and stuff. Now you had a bunch of brothers and sisters. And
right. I did. I'm the eighth child, so I'm the baby of the family, and by the time I came along, you know, my parents were in their mid to late 40s, and I think they'd had enough of child rearing, so they so they pretty much let me kind of run feral to a large extent, and my older brothers and sisters, who were all pretty much hippies in the 70s, were, you know, kind of were left with raising me or taking care of me. And And so
that explains absolutely quite a bit.
Yeah, evidently I was tear gassed at some rally in Madison because I was in a backpack on my sister's back at one point.
That's a good one.
You know, and so anyway, I pretty much was kind of let loose, and we started kind of just going out on our own, camping on our own at a pretty young age. And then a couple buddies and I got really into biking. We did a lot of cross-country biking through.
Yeah, that's what I understand. Yeah. Now, you got into biking like before high school or what, childhood, or when you were in high school? Did you go to high school in Madison?
Yeah, I did. Our high school was about 3 or 4 miles away from the house. And so we kind of grew up tinkering on bikes, and then we were riding bikes to school. You know, during high school, and most of the time we were riding our Schwinn 1 speeds that we'd found junked on, you know, on a curb or something. And
in fact, you stole them, didn't you?
Yeah, that's a nice way of saying it. I still have my original Schwinn 1 speed that I used throughout high school and college, And we...
kind of sentimental, eh?
It is. My buddy and I were hunters. A little, you know, in the fall we went hunting. At one point I dared him to try to shoot out my back tire on my bicycle. And that's all it took. He took a shot and it went right through the tire and through the fender. And that hole in the fender, that bullet hole, is still there.
Well, it's a peculiar thing to make yourself the target.
This is my good friend. But by the time we were 16, we had done a couple of trips throughout Wisconsin. And then I think.
Bicycle trips?
Yep. And then by the time.
Oh, you got real serious about it. Road trips.
Yeah. Yep. And we were, I think between our junior and senior year, we took off for the East Coast. I think
wow,
we were 16, 16 or 17,
Coast.
Yeah.
And when you say we, you and your brothers?
This was me and my friend Jimmy Brader, the shooter of my fender.
Oh, that guy, the guy with the gun.
I kind of think back, you know, I've worked through Grand Canyon Youth with kids who are 16 and 17 these days. And I think, oh, my God, we were so young. And we just hopped on our bikes and we're gone for 3 or 4 weeks. Up through Canada, right into Maine to visit a friend there. And
that
then,
sounds like some fantastic parenting you were under.
You know, I think I have this theory that, you know, my parents loved all their kids. But when you have 8, you kind of think, if we lose one, you know, it's not that big a deal. And, of course, it was, if we lose Danny, we'll feel sad, but no big deal.
Well, there were only 6 kids in my family, but I definitely identify with that. You know? And I had the same advantage as you had in a lot of ways by being one of the younger children.
Yep.
The older ones.
It was good for us.
They got tortured, tormented, and
went
through all the tough stuff. Give me a little bit about high school.
Sure.
How big of a high school was it?
It was, I think it was fairly large, but compared to big cities, Madison West Side, it was called Memorial High School. I think we had about 400 kids in our class.
In your graduating class.
Exactly. Yeah. And again, it was, it was a really safe, all of us wanted to get out of there every minute of the day, you know, none of us wanted to be sitting there in a desk. But at the same time, you know, we had really good teachers, we had really good, you know, liberal kind of education, and it set a lot of us up. You know, I was going to a Catholic grade school in 7th grade, and I got kicked out. So I went to the public school in 8th grade, and I was probably smoking more pot than most kids at that point in time.
Is that why you got thrown out of Catholic school?
A little bit of that was probably behavior related to marijuana use. So,
well, you sounded pretty foggy about this explanation, and we'll leave it at that.
That's exactly right. So I got into high school, and I think I wasted the first year or two. I did very little, you know, just kind of got by. My grades were crummy, and then something changed. I don't know what the heck changed, but all of a sudden I started paying attention, and by the time I was a senior, I was...
You probably fell off your bike right on top of your head.
It's probably...
It might have been something like that.
Very likely. I was the kid in high school who came up with the really obnoxious bad ways to have fun, and then everybody would do them, and then people would get caught, but somehow I would avoid, the consequences.
I have a similarity to that same role in my high school.
I know.
I knew I identified with you somehow.
Yep, that's right. So, you know, the teachers thought I was great.
And, you hung the moon.
And the hilarious, and then I would say, hey, let's go over to the pizza place and press our asses against the window. Everybody thought that was a good idea. And we would, we went and did that. And then just by coincidence, I was like, okay, I got to head home. And then 2 minutes later, the cop showed up and rounded everybody up. And somehow I avoided that completely after
the idea.
You
were inside the place having a piece of pizza.
That's right. Probably was. I'm just thinking... can you imagine the lineup,
that's too funny.
That's terrible. And, so my friends, they're always pretty loyal. Nobody ever turned me in.
That's pretty good.
I was lucky that way.
Yeah, you did have good friends. I had good friends, too, but there was one of them that always got caught, and he squealed like a pigeon or what is that, a Canary? Sang like a canary?
Yeah, I think that's it.
So you started getting pretty good grades and interested in the academic aspects of your junior, senior years.
I was a real science nerd by the time I finished.
Uh-huh, cool.
And I got out. You know, it's funny. School was so different back then, but I had wanted to do a bike ride up to Alaska, and I was itching to get out of school. And the last semester of my senior year, I think I only had three or four courses. And I went to each teacher and I said, can I take the exam early, like 3 weeks early, and get out of here and go ride up to Alaska? And every one of them said yes. None of them said, oh, I need a note from your parents.
And they all just...
they were like, okay. Oh, yeah. And I don't know if they wanted to get rid of me or just were like... Yeah.
Or they'd like the idea,
yeah.
Now, probably a little bit of both.
Very likely.
And so did you do it?
Yeah. So out of high school, I drove with a buddy. Goodness. We drove to Washington State. We rode around. We did a like a 4 or 5 day trip. Then he dropped me off in Seattle, where I waited for the ferry to go up to Haines. And I think I was there for 4 or 5 days, and I stayed in a like the men's shelter for the homeless with my bike. I was there with my bike and my panniers. And so then the ferry came in. I went up, rode from Haines to Anchorage, where I had a sister living at the time. And then I stayed for a couple months working, doing a couple different things. And then I rode back down the Alcan in the fall.
So you rode all the way back to the States?
Yep. Yep, all the way back to Wisconsin. And that was...
That's incredible.
It was pretty miserable.
Back in the old days, I drove the Alcan.
Oh, nice.
Up there and back. And that's a long ways.
Do you remember what year that is? I'm wondering if
it was like 75 or 76, maybe.
And my trip up there was 83.
Yeah, so, and the Alcan was really remote, and I'm sure it still is, but it was a dirt road all the way,
and
it went on and on. Yeah.
There were sections where, you know, I was riding 250 miles before getting into another town.
Yeah.
And it was hard, because I think that was the first trip that I did, elongated trip that I did alone. And I met a couple guys riding kind of in Canada, so I didn't do the whole thing alone, but... Yeah, that was a hard trip for me. You know, I was 18. And
that's unbelievable. That's an adventure.
Yeah, that was a
good one. Did you run into some people that really didn't warm up to a bicycle on the Alcan? Because, the way truck drivers drove on that thing is actually a really well-constructed road.
Yeah.
You could keep your speed because it banged.
You know, everything in the
Yukon. Everybody was pretty nice to you?
Yeah. I have to say, throughout all the biking that we did, I think I did probably about a handful of trips that were more than 1,000 miles, and that one I think was, 3,000.
Oh yeah,
it was a ways.
Yeah, that's phenomenal.
But we were always treated, you know, really well by people. We got very lucky. Everybody kind of looked out for us. You know, there was one time where I was on Highway 2 in Canada. This was our first trip when we went to the East Coast, when we went to Maine.
Uh-huh.
And we were, you know, it was one big highway, and there were no options to ride bikes on smaller, you know, highways. So you're on Canadian Highway 2 for a big length. I think we were on it for a couple hundred miles. But they have a big shoulder. The problem is that... you know, you've got plenty of room to ride a bike on the shoulder, but all the broken glass and all the debris and stuff that you want to avoid is kind of further away from the road.
Yeah, it bounces away on the shoulder. Yep.
So you're kind of riding right alongside the line where the traffic is. And at one point, it was raining and I had my hood on. And I'm just kind of looking straight forward and, you know, kind of miserably going along, hoping that the rain stops sometime. And I hear this thing just go right by my ear. And I look up, and here we're being passed by a truck that's got a trailer and got a like a tractor on the back of the trailer. And those big belt wheels are hanging off by 3 or 4 feet on each side. And this thing went right by my ear and over my shoulder. And, I was just 6 inches away from getting my head ripped off by this thing. I'm sure the trucker had no idea he was, the thing was overhanging that much or that he was going to come that close to us.
Oh, my goodness.
And I look up, and my friend Jimmy is in front of me. And sure enough, the thing goes right over his shoulder.
Oh, wow.
And I think There was a silence for a while, and Jim said, "How close was that, Dan?" And I said, "Yeah, that was pretty close." And then we didn't say anything for a while. We just kept trying.
And then found the next restroom. Yeah, you know, you're really, especially in those days, people aren't really oriented towards bicycles some of these roadways. So I bet you've got all kinds of stories of terror.
Yeah, a couple. We tried to get out of the way as much as we could, and we did pretty good. But, you know, back then, we would have never worn a helmet.
I haven't invented them yet. I think the football players had leather things.
That's right.
But so what kind of bike were you on? I mean, just out of curiosity, the equipment.
I actually had most of my biking I did on the first year Cannondale came out with aluminum touring frames. And the reason why I got one of those is because I was working in a bike shop throughout high school. And so I got a good deal on a new Cannondale touring bike. And that was...
Like a 10-speed touring bike type thing?
Yep, it was pretty nice. My friend Jimmy, on the other hand, he had bought a Schwinn 10-speed World Traveler for $17 at the police auction.
It weighed four times the weight of the Cannondale.
Yeah, and he always outbiked me on it for sure. So.
He did?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it made me mad.
And you know, a question I've always had from your perspective is how many Dan Halls have you met?
Oh, yeah, there's several here in this community.
There's a couple, Boatman even. Yeah, that's right. There's Dan Hall that's married to Emily Dan.
Are they married?
No, I don't think they are. Ooh, that's a faux pas.
Every time I see Emily, I apologize to her, you know, because she has to go around saying, "Oh, yeah, my boyfriend is Dan Hall." And, you know, people are aghast. Like, what? Do you need a therapy?
What are you doing with him?
But he's a super nice guy. And then the other Dan Hall, you know, worked for Game and Fish and then worked for ARR.
Right.
And he, you know, I always called him the better looking Dan Hall. Many of my friends called him the better smelling Dan Hall.
Some people called him the Dan Hall.
But he's a super nice guy, too. I think those poor guys had to put up with all the dastardly things that have been said about me.
It's a cumulative thing.
They could probably sue, get a lawyer and sue.
And so as you got done with this adventure right out of high school, you got off the bike and had to do something with your life because you weren't making much money riding your bike.
No, I don't think I was. You know, that it's funny because our first trip to Maine, we had $100. We had actually $200 each. We had $100 for going out, and then we had to come back on the bus, on the Greyhound, which cost about $100, because my buddy had the only way his mom would let him go is if he was back for their family reunion. So he had to be back. So our plan was to ride out, take the Greyhound back. That was an experience all itself, being on the Greyhound at 17 and going through New York and Philly.
Oh, all bad. I bet you met some interesting people on the Greyhound bus.
Yes, we surely did. So, but we made it 20 days out there, and we each had $5 a day to spend on food. And so
you had enough.
Strangely enough, we made it fine. You know, but I just think back and, you know, we didn't have enough money. We knew we couldn't afford to camp any place, you know, that charged you to camp there because we didn't have that kind of money. So we were always just looking for places to lay out, farmers' fields or little county parks.
Oh, yeah, waller into the hedge somewhere.
Yep, exactly. When I got back from Alaska, I pretty much decided to go to school. I just barely got good enough grades to get into the university. And so...
And which university?
University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Oh, wow.
So I think I went back there after meeting some people in Alaska who kind of gave me some ideas of interesting courses to take. I went back to Madison and...
And you had a little direction in your...
Yeah, a little. I mean, I went... I got interested in philosophy, so I took a lot of philosophy courses, and that became my major. And then I I got into glass blowing, which was kind of a really strange thing.
Well, that
thing
was one
do.
Of my next questions, yeah. is the glass blowing. Yeah. Let's stick with this as far as, were you at Madison for 4 years, 5 years?
Oh, no, I had a very ambitious college career. I think I was there for 10 years, maybe.
Oh, really?
Goofing off as much as I could. I loved the university. Tuition was...
It's a good place to be, school.
Yeah, yeah.
Remember that, you listeners that are young people, kids.
Well, this is going to be make people mad. You know, my tuition was $600 when I first started going per semester. So,
yeah. Yeah, no, it's a whole different deal.
Yeah.
But and $600 was a lot more money back then.
Well, it was, but it was the kind of money you could raise. What I ended up doing a lot was raising money by working for a semester and then going back to school for the following yeah. semester. And then towards the end, you know, after 6 or 7 years, I got a degree in philosophy, and then I went back to get a second degree, a teaching cert. So I wanted to teach kids with special needs. I was working at a camp in the summer mm-hmm. times. So I got that degree as well, and I think at that point my parents were like, we're just going to give you some money to get through at this point.
Well, they probably admired your... dedication, motivation.
I don't think that dedication was what
they admired. Something to give you, girl. Okay, there was something.
They admired the idea of not having their 22-year-old son come back and live in the basement.
Yeah, it's funny how you can convince people of your worth of different ways. You're done with school. You've been in Madison all your life.
Yep.
Except for
yep.
your bicycle tours and stuff like that. And then where does the world take you?
Yeah, well, I had a buddy in high school. You know, we were kind of the kids who were known as kind of outdoorsy camper types. And he moved to Salt Lake City for school. And he called me about a year into it. And he said, you're not going to believe this, but last summer I worked for a company that paid me to camp with people. I said, what? How do I sign up for that?
No kidding.
I said, well, how much did you get paid? He said, $800 a month, including all the food you can eat. And I was like, that's like a trip.
It's like you just
won the lottery.
Opportunity to go to heaven.
Oh, my gosh. And then he said, you know, they inflate these rubber boats and they put them on a river and you go down a river. And I said, well, that sounds kind of like a dumb idea, but it sounds good enough if they'll pay me $800 to do that. So, you know, that was working for Bob Quist at Moki Mac up in Green River, Utah.
Well, you know, I remember that you are a Moki boy.
Yep.
And
yep.
working for Bob Quist is yep. beyond your 10 years in college.
Oh, my gosh.
It's beyond anybody's imagination of an education.
It was quite something, and we were just so happy to get... You know, he put us up in an old house that was kind of like a barn-like
house. Green River?
In Green River when we weren't on the water.
And for the listener, Moki Mac is a Grand Canyon outfit that is one of the original outfitters. Bob yeah. and Claire's yeah. father and the sister,
Annie.
And Richard. Yep. And so four kids. But they did those early trips in Glen Canyon, Boy Scout trips.
That's exactly right.
And so a great tradition and history behind the Moki Mac boys. They have since sold to a larger company, but yep. they have a great and honorable tradition. And not a lot of guys can say they started back then.
Yeah,
Yeah. But, you know, getting back to... your experience in Green River, I mean, that. So you got a plane ticket and went to Green River or drove or rode your bike?
Oh, I think I drove every time. I rode my bike out once to Utah.
You did?
Yep.
From
I
Madison.
Rode out once.
Wow.
And, but most of the time I would just go back and forth. I had an old, what did I have at that time? I had a 1963 AMC Classic four-door. And
land yachties,
yeah, that yeah looked like a bubble sort of, and you know I'd take that out there and have that out there. So.
And so you guys were mostly doing cat trips at first, or what were
yeah.
you? Or
cat Westwater and Deso was what the
was
permits
the permits
were.
Yep. were. Yeah.
And honestly, the funny thing was is that I got out there. One of the things that made me valuable to Bob was my college. Semester got out like 3 weeks earlier than most of the colleges in the West. So I was there early. I was kind of the only guy there for the, you know, probably in, I don't know, late April, probably. And he had a Grand Canyon trip. He hadn't been down in Grand Canyon for 5 years, but Claire needed him to run a 2-boat motor trip. And so he hauled me along. So my first river trip was in Grand Canyon.
Oh, wow. Actually,
yeah.
Serendipity, huh?
Yeah. So I was swamping for this 2-boat motor trip, and I was the only swamper because my buddy who'd got me involved got pulled off on another rowing trip. So I was down there with Bob and Ronnie Beecher. I don't know if you
remember. Yeah, Ronnie Beecher, famous Wallapai guy.
Yeah. Yep. And I'll tell you, those guys just disliked me as much as you possibly could.
They did.
And, you know, I was worthless. You know, I mean, I was completely green. I had no idea of how to do anything. They hadn't seen each other for 5 years, and they're old buddies, and they just wanted to hang out and drink at night and have a good time.
And boy, did they ever drink at night, yep. Probably.
And I'll tell you, the funny thing about that trip, you know, it was a 10-day trip that it rained almost the whole time. And the poor people were beat up from the rain. And Bob and Ronnie probably drank more because of the rain than they should have. We got down to, you know, this was back when they were running 30 and 5 on a daily basis. The fluctuations were 30,000 to 5,000. So we got to Crystal, and it was in the morning on the low. It was 5,000, and I was on Bob's boat, and we ran through on the left side at Crystal, and he pulls into the Slate Creek eddy on the left, you know, in a big boat. I don't know, do people do that normally or not? I'm not sure.
Not so much.
Yeah, so he pulled in there, and here comes Ronnie, and Ronnie runs right up on the Slate Creek rock out there, you know, on the left side, and he's stuck. His boat's just wedged right up there, kind of at an angle. So Bob says, "All right, Dan, here's what we're going to do. You get on the front of the boat and you grab our bow line and you pull up. I'll pull you right up and nose right up to his boat, and you tie it around a D-ring on this boat and tie a bowline." And I was like, "Oh, was the bowline the knot that you showed me the other day where the rabbit comes out of the hole and it goes around the tree?
Around the tree, back in the hole. That's the one."
He's like, "Yeah, that's the one." And I was like, "Oh, okay, I think I remember that one, you know." So I'm leaning out there and I'm getting beat up by the waves, and I tie my knot, and then I hop on. He says, "Hop on Ronnie's boat." So I do, and he pulls out of the current, and of course the line snaps, and I just thought, "Oh crap! That was
That was your ride home too, though."
Yeah, and honestly, what ended up happening was the D-ring pulled off the rubber. Of course, I should have tied on the frame, but Bob had told me where to tie it, so I thought, okay.
Why question the master boater?
So
right?
I lucked out on that. So now I'm on Ronnie's boat, and Ronnie says, "You hop on the rock and push the boat off, and I will motor back here and try to motor us off." And I just didn't think that there was anything unusual about that. I said, "Okay, I'll get on the rock." So I'm out in the middle of Crystal, standing on the Slate Creek rock, trying to push the front of the boat off. And eventually it pulled off, and I hopped on, and downstream
off you went. And they started liking you.
Oh, I don't know, maybe a little bit more. But the funny thing about that is I was telling that story about 15 years later on a river trip with Jeff Gorley, and he was on an expeditions trip. They pulled out and scouted lava from the top of the hill, and they saw our boat, and they saw this guy out on the rock pushing the boat off, and they thought, "What dumbass would be..."
Oh, you mean Crystal, not lava.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I said lava. Yeah, and Crystal, and Jeff swears he got a picture of me out there, you know, on the rock, but he's never been able to locate the picture.
Yeah, so there you go.
Dang. But
that's impressive.
That was my first trip, and honestly, after that trip, I didn't think I was going to go back and work the river. Bob didn't need me for a week, and I had a brother in Phoenix, so I was thinking, I'm going to go down to Phoenix and think about whether I'm going to head up to Green River and work this season, because these guys were kind of miserable to work with. And then in thinking about that, Bob gave me a call, and and kind of reluctantly, but did apologize for the way he treated me on that trip. And
he did?
He did. And that made all the difference in the world. I said, okay, well, I'll see you.
Young, tender feelings of a young man.
I was very tender.
Well, and also, Bob's the sweetest guy on the planet. Oh, he is. Just an amazing guy.
Yep. Yep. He is a really sweet guy, and I learned a ton from Bob. And you know, Richard would come down and do trips. And, you know, Richard and I were just, you know, tight. He was a really great guy, too.
Uh-huh.
I really love those guys.
Yeah. Well, they're a great family.
Yep.
And I intend to sit down with Bob sometime, go on a road trip and sit down with
should.
Him. And same thing with Claire and Pam.
Yeah.
So then that became a habit. You worked for them for a while, or?
Yeah, about, well, you know, actually, I think I did two seasons and then I got fired. And then I got rehired by Bob's brother. So Bob fired me in a fit. He said, you know, go and pack your things and move out. And so then I came back.
But what brought Bob to firing you? Don't dance on that. Come on. What happened?
Well, honestly, it was really about I was seeing a woman who was working for another company, and she had a longer season. And so I kind of overstayed my welcome at the boatman's shop.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, and that really was pretty much it. There were a couple other things that I just, you know, but whatever the case, the next season I ended up in Utah because I got a Westwater permit, and I got a bunch of my buddies from Wisconsin, and we all drove out to do Westwater, and we run into Richard at Ray's Tavern. And Richard says, oh my God, I need seven boatmen tomorrow to do this, you know, this big trip that I've promised the Mormon church that we do every year. And he said, and here you are with, you know, six of your friends, and you guys could do this. And we had just gotten beat up in Westwater. I mean, we literally, Westwater was running at like 17.5 the day that we got there.
Oh, my.
And it was so nasty. And I had never seen it. You know, I'd run it, you know, a couple dozen times, you know, the years before. But I'd never seen it that water level. And, you know, we just got beat up. And my friend Jimmy Brader fell out of the boat and got pulled under at the Room of Doom.
Room of Doom.
Oh, my God. It was a mess. And we got off that river, and my friends thought I had tried to kill him, you know. And so we're all kind of at Ray's Tavern that evening having a beer, and in walks Richard. He says, I need you guys to do this one day daily stretch on the Green River daily section. And my friends were like, are you nuts? We're not guides. We couldn't do that. And I said, well, it's a pretty easy river, you know. So we all went and did that the next day. And
oh, that's fantastic.
And it was a fiasco. It was
it was a complete fiasco.
There was one place in the river at House Rock Rapid where you could get in a little trouble. And sure enough, one boatman went in between these two big boulders where there was a little hole. And we all just followed, thinking he knew something we didn't. But in essence, he would kind of was daydreaming or something and just forgot that he shouldn't go there. So I watched my friends, you know, I think I went through and I watched my friends come through and they drop off people left and right. You know, there were swimmers everywhere. And I watched one friend throw a throw bag out to a swimmer, which I thought, wow, good job. Unfortunately, didn't hold on to one end of it.
Just threw it out there.
You know, one of my other friends went to grab somebody back into his boat and her life jacket came completely up over her head. And, you know, and
it was a fiasco.
It was a fiasco. We stopped after that for lunch. And there were people who chose to walk 2 or 3 miles down the road instead of getting back in the boats. Oh, my God.
That's fantastic.
It was really hilarious. So anyway, and then Richard hired me, you know, after Bob had fired me the previous season. Richard said, I need you to stay for 6 weeks just for to get some work done. And Bob's down in Grand again, and he won't know, and you'll be on the river when he comes back, and then he's got another trip, and then you'll come back and run another trip, and that's the way it worked. And in the end, Bob was really grateful to have me that year, even though he had
fired
me in the previous. So So I kind of did a little work for them kind of every summer for about 7 years. And then I made the transfer down to the Grand, mostly because I was kind of done running up in Utah and I was ready to kind of move on to something else. And then I kind of got pulled back in to working in the Grand by a wilderness first responder course. The Grand Canyon River Guides were running the first wilderness first responder.
Right, right.
Taught like west of the Mississippi. And they had a guy come out from Maine, a guy named Denny Kerrigan, who was the best instructor ever. He was just fantastic. And I was in that course with who's who of the river community. Bruce and Nancy Helene were there, Krista Sadler, Andre Potocnik, Jed Kohler, Greg Reif was there. Rod Nash was in that course.
Lots of names.
And nobody knew me because I really hadn't worked in Grand Canyon. I'd been just working up in Utah.
They didn't know you day one, but they knew you on day seven.
Yeah, I'm afraid they did. So sure enough, Bert Jones and Mike Borchek were also in that course.
Oh, boy.
And those guys said, hey, come and row a boat for OU. And I got hooked up with OU for about 7 or 8 seasons.
Yeah. I remember all that.
Yep.
Great.
Yeah.
And then the commercial river running is one thing, but you kind of took a angle towards the sciences, and you got interested in botany, I would imagine.
Yeah. I think, my first full season in Grand Canyon, I think that's right, was 1994. And at the end of that year, I had hooked up with the Arizona Conservation Corps, and I was building trails in the National Forest in Arizona and different places in Arizona. And it turned out that I knew there was a river trip, oftentimes in November, that Kim Crumbo would run, where he'd use volunteer boatmen in November, and we'd go down and he'd collect people and they'd go down and do resource management work, mostly trail work back then, trails in the corridor. But there was always a veg person and they were doing re-veg or doing something with the plants or eradication of invasive species. And then there was always an archaeology person. And I'm pretty sure on one of those trips was the first time I met your lovely wife, Jen Durker, and I did some archaeology work, but I got really involved in the resource management work that the park was doing down there.
Well, and back then, too, that's a really educational, like all those disciplines, trails, the archaeology, but especially the veg work that was going on was really
it was
a priority back then.
It was pretty impressive. And, so I was working for the ACC, and I told my boss, hey, I could take a couple guys off my crew. Well, actually, I thought I could take the entire crew. You know, they're looking for people who have trail building experience to do this work. And we could get a free river trip for the entire crew. And I called up the people who were kind of organizing it then were Bill Gleckler and over at ARR and then a couple other, owners. And they basically said, we really only could take two of your crew and you. We really only have spots for three more people. And you'd have to row a boat, And I said, well, that's no big deal. I can row a boat and I'll see what my boss says. And my boss said, sure, just take two from your crew and go and do this. But he said, you have to have your guys on your boat all the time, for safety reasons, whatever. And I kind of said, hey, there are guys on this trip that have done hundreds of trips, and I've done like 10 at this point in Grand Canyon. And I said, I don't, if you insist that's the way it's got to be, but I don't think it's really a safety thing. And he said, no, it's got to be that way. So we get to Flagstaff. We're packing up at ARR. We get to the ferry. Kim Crumbo's organizing everything. And I start to realize that there's not a boat for me. And I didn't absolutely want to row a boat. It didn't really matter to me all that much, but I had made this promise to my boss. And I went to Kim and I said, I don't think I could fake it you know, for 20 days that they were...
That you didn't have a boat taking care of the other guys.
We're going to bring photos back. You know? And to Kim's credit, he, you know, he was such a good guy in so many ways. And to his credit, he said, hey, Dan, if you, doesn't matter to me, if you want to drive back to Flagstaff and get a boat and bring it up here for launch tomorrow, I'd be happy to let you do that. And that's what we did. I had driven my own truck up to the ferry. And so we went down. I called up Bert at OU and I said, Bert, would, you know, could I borrow a boat for this resource trip? And he said, sure. And so, you know, thanks to John Vail, I took one of their boats and went down. And
How cool is that?
That was great.
And you became your own little outfitter.
Yep. And I proceeded to have some of the worst runs ever on those trips because everybody else was very, you know, trained. And here I was. I just remember the guys watched me go through the left side at Grapevine. And they just, you know, I just had this huge run over there thinking, was that the run? Wasn't that the run? And they're like, we've never seen anybody over there. Good job. I can't believe you got through
there. You know, you kind of learn things down there the hard way, whether you've got a great instructor or not. That's kind of how it is. I do want to just plug in something. You brought up Kim.
Yeah.
And Collie, we here at Big Adventures want to tip our hat his way.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, he was lost up on Lake Shoshone up there with his brother, Mark O'Neill. But we tip our hat to those guys. It's a it's a loss to the community as well as the world.
Yeah. But, you know, I was
remarkable
very lucky
guys.
To
yeah.
work a couple trips with Kim or doing those resource management.
Yeah, he had a remarkable story. Maybe old Lou and I will put together some stuff and we'll do a Kim Crumbo
that'd be
session
sweet.
Sometime. Yep. But anyway, back to you.
Yeah.
That kind of started you on a pretty long-term project.
Yeah, I think we are all instilled, everybody who worked those trips, and primarily was boatmen who were, you know, done with their commercial season, we all instilled with, you know, the feeling like we needed to, you know, watch out for the canyon and take care of the canyon from an environmental standpoint. And so one of those projects, Larry Stevens was on many of those trips, and he told us all about Ravenna and how to spot it and, you know, how to kill it. And the thing about this particular fountain grass that's invaded the canyon is that it's one out of about 200 invasive species that we could actually eradicate out of the canyon. We could actually get it.
Really, 250?
Yeah, about approximately.
Explain how invasives can have such a tough play on a native environment and stuff.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
I probably can.
Well, we're sitting here talking. why don't you?
I'm just not sure how good I'm going to be at it. But
don't be too windy. Just get this thing across.
Well, you know, the park has about 1,700 species of plants in the entire park. About 10% or a little more than 10% are invasive or non-native plants that have come in one way or another. And each species has its own kind of origination story of how it got into our system. 99% of those plants are going to be things that we might be able to control in some areas in the same way you'd control weeds in your garden, but we're not going to be able to get out of our system. And when some of the non-native or invasive plants come into the system, they just have a tendency to take over and monoculture, what we call monoculture. So they'll outcompete a lot of the native plants. And some of the plants, we have quite a few, not only native plants, but endemic plants. So they grow no place else on the planet except in Grand Canyon. And several of those are plants that only grow in the Muav corridor, in the 25 miles between, you know, mile 40 and mile 65. So, you know, you really want to protect those species. And plants like camel thorn and tamarisk and Ravenna will come in and just take over habitat.
What are the endemics through there? Just a few names.
Well, McDougall's Flavaria, or oftentimes called Grand Canyon Flavaria, is one that you only find in the in the Muav Gorge. That is a late, kind of a fall-blooming aster that you see at, actually, you can see it from the river in a couple places, but one of the real common places is Ledges Camp. You can, as you pass by Ledges Camp in the fall, it will be blooming up on the right there near that.
Near that spring. In the spring, yeah.
And there's a couple of Metzelias, Metzelia wallapiensis, and gosh, I can't remember the species of the other Metzelia. That family is called the Blazing Stars, and there's a couple endemic species there in the same area. Mm-hmm. Ross's Spurge is another. Is that right, Ross's Spurge? It's another endemic. I've seen that on the trail up to the granaries at Nankweep. So there's quite a few. The reason why we have more endemics than one would think is because the canyon itself acts as an island. It's a barrier system. It's just like an island in the middle of the ocean where we see a lot of endemics on islands. We see a lot of endemics in the park because we've got this huge barrier canyon and a big desert in the Southwest, and it kind of acts the same way.
And the different life zones, as you go down from the rim to the river, play a factor.
Absolutely.
That well.
So, that's exactly right. So we end up having, I think there's almost 30, right around 30 endemic species to the park, which is many more than you would expect.
But not very many if you're trying to protect them.
Correct.
I mean, you don't have a lot of breathing room around these invasives.
Right. And when you look at the corridor and what's there, you know, it's a very small footprint of land. You know, it's, you know, so the riparian environment and everything in the corridor at the bottom of the canyon is not a whole lot of space. And so what you've got there, you don't have a whole lot of place to go.
Pretty critical boundaries.
Exactly.
How are we doing with the, let's just talk about Ravenna grass. I mean, that's been a real target species to eradicate.
Yep, absolutely.
Is there hope?
Yeah, we had a real breakthrough this year, actually, kind of a milestone. So when we were first killing it, the program's about 30 years old now. And when we were first killing it, we were doing it with groups of 10 or 20. We'd pull up to a beach. Sometimes we'd get 600, 700, 800 plants on one beach, you know, and so it took a lot of people to kind of walk around slowly and find them and kill them. And Ravenna can be, you know, dug out of the ground and put on a rock or in a bush for the roots to dry out, and it's done once the roots are dry. If it's got seed heads, we pull the seed heads and put them in our trash. This is a big fountain grass that can get 15 feet high sometimes, and 10, 12 feet in diameter. We found big ones like that. A lot of times when they're only a year or two old, they're just, you know, waist high. And once they get around 6 feet, they'll put out a seed head.
So, yeah, they're very distinctive. You can see them from a long ways off once you're trained in.
Yep, exactly.
Like I got trained in by Larry on Ravenna way back then. So
we were getting 10,000 plants a trip back then.
Oh, is there really numbers like that? Yeah, I had no idea.
Yep. And but in the starting around 2000 and, oh, I don't know, maybe 2002 or 2003, the numbers started to dive. And the park was working on it kind of, they put it on a lot of their trips as kind of a side project. And the numbers kept going down. And eventually we got to around 2010 and we were down around 1,000 plants per trip, and, you know, with people looking as diligently as they could. Mm-hmm. And then right around 2014, the Park Service, for a lot of different reasons, lost the resources and lost the right people to kind of really kind of usher this in and stopped doing river trips for the park. And at that point, I think I was the only one working on it from 2014 to 2020. So there was about 6 years in there where it was just me, which was kind of crazy. I was kind of the crazy. It became a little bit like I was the Labrador with the tennis ball. I could not pass up a Ravenna plant without
killing it. Well, I think what people really kind of thought you were losing it is when you were eradicating it in the nude with it taped on you, the dead plants.
Right, that's
it was
right.
kind of a apocalypse now-y sort of. You kind of got a little out there.
I wanted to send a message to the plants that were still alive.
So where are we at right now? This is 2021. Yeah. We're sitting with that guy that really watched this thing.
So a couple years ago, I partnered with Melissa McMaster. Mm-hmm. She was the head of the corridor invasive program back before 2014. And she and I went to the park and said, look, we would like to finish up this project. We think we can kill this off if you let us.
Just let us.
And, we said, you don't need to give us any money or equipment. We can figure that out on our own. We just need access. We just need an admin permit to go and do this. And, it'd be best to have two trips a year, one in September and one in October. That's when it's got the seed heads up and blooming and we can see it the best. And they can be very small, short trips. We just need to run down there, kill what we see, and then we think we can get it done. We said we'd kind of look at it after 4 years of treatment of two trips. And in 2020, the Park Service, thanks to a couple people there who really were on our side, helped us get those permits. And so in 2020, we did our first trip last year on an ADMID permit. It was just a two-boat trip. Me and Chris McIntosh were running the boats, and Melissa was on the upper. And then this year, we went back down and we did a three-boat trip, and we had a handful of people that were probably the most skilled at seeing Ravenna from the river. It's not difficult to see if you're looking right at it, but to pick it out from 200 meters away.
And a bunch of surrounding vegetation.
Exactly. And a lot of it looks like
tough.
It itself.
I've tried.
Yep. And so we had some really the most skilled people seeing it in that environment. And we only came up with 94 plants this last October.
Oh, that's remarkable.
That was a real milestone. So we're in the double digits
so
now.
So you feel good about that because you had some pretty skilled eyes on the prize.
You always know that you missed some.
Mm-hmm.
But over the years, what we've kind of come up with is that, eventually we'll spot them. Eventually they'll get big enough and they'll get, they just want to be... kind of want to be showing. They want to have their seed head above everything else.
They can't run, but they can hide.
Yep. So I'm sure we missed some plants, but we've always figured we might have missed 5 to 10%.
Well, if I were you, I'd continue the program even if you get out of there with 5 plants.
Yep, yep.
And knowing you, that's probably what
I'm
you're
a little afraid
do.
That. So, sure enough, this year was the first year that we got some funding to do it, which is great. We got funding for 22, and thanks to GCROA, and thanks to, I think it's the Arizona Water Fund, but really the credit goes to Melissa because she's diligently applied
for
grants.
She's been remarkably dedicated.
Oh, she's great. She's great. Don't tell her I said so.
Well, I think we need to have her on this show.
Yeah, that would be a good
idea. That would be a good one.
Oh, she's got some stories to tell.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's where we're at now with Ravenna. We feel really good about that. And, it wasn't always just a small group of people. Like you said, you got trained up on it. And, 20 years ago, there were 100 guides who were killing Ravenna.
Oh, yeah, we were pretty active with it, and there was enough of it to where you could be an idiot and still find the stuff, right? Which I probably was just...
Well, no, I mean, there's a lot of people to thank for, this project, and it's really been... I think from the Park Service standpoint, I wish they'd take more credit for it. It's really kind of phenomenal... progress to kind of get an invasive species like that out of the entire system.
Yeah, well, you're very gentle about the change of things in 2014, and they're really getting things back together and fixing some things that were broken.
Yep.
And they're the stewards of our greatest national treasure, and you got to be behind their. They do a lot of really good things.
Yeah,
and that's one of them.
There's some incredible people there who would who love the place and are doing great work.
Yeah.
You know.
And I think they've got great leadership now with Ed.
Yeah.
I had a great visit with him on for the show, and I think he's really got his eyes on the right things.
I agree. I've heard just great things about it.
And off this subject.
Sure.
You had a radio show when you were in Madison.
Yeah, a little bit.
I want to hear a little bit about the radio show.
Okay. Well, so when I was in Madison going to the university for those many years, I got involved with an improv group that we did a stage show. We did four shows a week. You know, it was kind of classic.
Radio
improv.
Shows?
Nope, this was actually on the stage.
Four a week?
Four a week. We did two shows on Friday and two shows on Saturday. And,
wow.
We were having a hilarious time. It was really fun. And then a bunch of those guys, one of the guys had a radio show on the public radio station, WORT in Madison, Wisconsin.
Wart.
And he said, hey, I'm going to, he was playing music late Sunday nights. And he said, how about if I carve out a 30-minute slot where we do an improv show on the radio? And we thought, oh, that sounds like a great idea. So we had a guy who played the keyboard. He was just this amazing guy, Dave Adler, who could play anything. Just hearing it once, he could play it. He knew every song that had been written. I mean, he was an impressive guy. And we had, I think there was about six or seven of us involved. And and we called it the Mirth Mart. The Mirth Mart. So we would... We would come up with some gimmick, some improvisational gimmick, and we'd ask callers to call in and give us, suggestions, and then we would come up with something. I remember I did
the... Oh, you guys must have had a ball.
Oh, it was terrible. It was bad radio at its best. And I think I did this thing called the Astronomic Soothsayer, Astrologic Soothsayer. It was the ass. So I was, somebody would call in and they'd give us their name and I'd read them their fortune, by using their name as an acronym. So yeah, I guess it was the Acronomic Soothsayer.
That had to have been pretty fun and insulting.
Terrible.
It was had to have been insulting.
It was almost always. I remember somebody called in, they wouldn't use their, I'm sure this was a made up name, but they just said, Bob Smith, my name is Bob Smith. And I think, so we are all around this table, so somebody writes down Bob Smith and then everybody kind of sends the sheet around and everybody starts filling in the words. And I'm kind of stalling on the radio as this kind of comes up. And all of a sudden the sheet gets thrown in front of me and I says, here's your fortune. Bob Smith, beware of big smelly men in the hot tub. Bob Smith, acronym for Bob Smith. We thought that was... really fine. Somebody at the radio station heard that and put a kibosh on the whole thing.
Oh, it shut you down.
They were like, this is not appropriate for public radio.
For public radio. The cane hook came on out, didn't it?
So I think we did that.
Entertainment
for about a
year. It can be a mean business.
Oh, that was really rough. So, yeah, but we had a great deal of fun, I think. Oh, terrible stuff.
Oh, I'll tell you what, great stuff. We are kind of running out of time, but I always like to ask, especially people like you with such an investment in our natural world and our such a...
You're being kind.
Well, no, it's true, though. I mean, look at how our open spaces, our open roads, bicycling, our wildlands and stuff like that. What hope have we got in the future, and can we whip things around? I mean, it isn't just global warming and our precious environment degradation as far as our atmosphere and all that, but are there enough people to turn this thing around, or are there too many people, and is this a... Do you have optimism?
Larry Stevens is a hero to many of our community, And he was the one who inspired me, and he just said, you take one little thing and you work on it, and you make the whole thing better. And I think that was what really inspired me to take on Ravenna. And I've been working on it for almost 30 years, you know. So, you know, it's a small thing. It's just one species in a big system. But you know, we've had some good luck with it. And so, you know, I think it's everybody can play a part in just doing something, you know, that may seem small, but in the end, it ends up being a big thing.
Well, those are really good, solid, wise words.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where they came from. Thanks for writing those down for me to read here.
I'm emotional. But, you know, for the listeners, you know, let's all take heart to that as far as what is that one little thing that we can do to make a safer environment for wilderness and try and, you know, one little thing is all of us do one little thing and you start stacking up a bunch of progress towards protecting what we've got left.
Yep,
but really that's brilliant stuff. That could be a good mantra for all of us.
Kudos to Larry.
Kudos to Larry, but kudos to you and kudos to the people that have tolerated us today listening to us. It's been a really fun conversation. I hope you guys have enjoyed it out there. And you know what? The COVID thing keeps rearing its ugly head. So I really do, even if you're an anti-vaxxer or whatever, change your mind. Get your vaccines. Get the boosters. I mean, if there was no vaccination, it probably would have wiped out the human species by now, this little rascal. So go ahead and do that. Change your mind. Get your vaccines. And stay right side up. This is Dan Hall and Brian Durker.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Adventures. Thank you, Dan.
Take care.
We look forward to our next visit.
All right.
Big Adventures is produced by Brian Durker, Margaret Knight, and me, Gavin Bugner. Bill Gleckler and his mandolin provide our music. If you like our show, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.